This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. You've heard the adage that oysters are safer to eat in months containing an R. It's February, and local oysters are at their peak. Patricia Smith is the Public Information Officer with the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries.
That's the time where basically they are not producing, and when they're not producing, they are getting fatter.
Oyster harvesting season in North Carolina lasts 6 months, from October to March. Due to restrictions enforced this month, fishermen now have fewer places in which they can harvest shellfish. On January 22nd, the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources announced that the closure of more than 300,000 acres of North Carolina waters to shellfishing would begin in February. The closure affects waters in the Albemarle Sound, Currituck Sound, the Upper Pungo River, and Upper Neuse River. Smith says the closures are due to budget tightening.
Last year, when everybody was told to look for budget reductions, the Division of Marine Fisheries was told to as well. And we found this would save about $148,000, give or take some. And that's a reduction in staff and the office and operation expenses that go along with it.
Smith says the closures did not go through a public hearing process.
This was something that had been in the works really since the passage of the budget this past summer.
The shellfish closures eliminate 80 sampling sites, which means 480 fewer water quality samples taken each year. Under federal shellfish regulations, if areas are not surveyed, they must be closed to shellfishing. The North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources samples all the shellfish sites in the state because they must be done in a certified lab. Currently, there's 912 sampling sites along the coast. Smith says areas that have been non-productive were chosen for the closure.
So we weren't really getting oyster and clam harvest from these waters. They just were waters that we were still, you know, still sampling, still sending people out to see how the pollution levels were for oyster harvest and things when there really was no harvest there.
According to Smith, the closure will have very little impact. This week I contacted several fishermen who do business near the closed waters in Bellhaven, Edenton, and Swan Quarter. Most said they didn't know about the shellfish closure and prefer working the more bountiful Pamlico Sound. I did speak with owner and operator of Foster Seafood in Bellhaven, Floyd Foster.
Well, I deal in just local seafood. No imports or anything. Buy from the fishermen.
Foster says the closure has had very little effect on his business because they harvest most of their oysters near the mouth of the Pungo River near Rose Bay. The most recent closure affects Upper Pungo River, an area Foster says was once brimming with shellfish.
It varies through the years, you know. Sometimes it is, and sometimes it ain't, which one area that closed back in the 50s, that was a really producing place, but then they opened up Pungo with all the farm water, the poisonous stuff running down into it, and it killed everything out there. My daddy and all the old-timers around here said it would, and it did, and I remember it opened it up in 1960.
The North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries Shellfish Sanitation Program began in 1925 following outbreaks of typhoid fever in Chicago, New York, Washington, and several other cities linked to tainted shellfish. Since the recent closures were put into place February 4th, Public Information Officer Patricia Smith says she hasn't heard much response from the public.
You know, I really haven't heard from any fishermen about this since this happened. There was one woman who emailed us, and it turned out that the water she was talking about is waters that's been closed for 6 years, didn't have anything to do with this.
300,000 acres of coastal water seems like a large area to close to shellfishing, but fishermen who actually know about the closures don't seem too concerned with the move. It's the best-case scenario, with budget reductions happening and very little impact to local fishermen. To see a list of the waters that closed to shellfish harvesting and a map of recreational water quality sampling sites that are still being tested, visit our website, publicradioeast.org. The North Carolina Symphony will be performing Mozart's Magnificent Voyage in New Bern on March 8th. This theatrical symphony performance features the music of the 18th century composer while telling the story of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's young son Karl, who longs to spend more time with his famous father. Today, Mac McKee speaks with Associate Conductor for the North Carolina Symphony, David Glover, about the upcoming performance and the Colonial Capital.
The combination of music and theater seems to be a unique presentation to introduce kids and their parents to classical music. Can you give our listeners about what to expect during the program?
This performance will take our audience on a journey with the great composer Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart and his young son, Carl. And during the course of the show, they're going to travel all over Europe as Wolfgang Mozart shows his son all the different places that he performed as a kid, all the different courts, all the different amazing people that he had a chance to perform for. And it's also going to explore a number of Mozart's works, especially the opera, The Magic Flute, which he's going to be describing to his son, Carl.
One of the themes that runs through this show, of course, is that special longing that Mozart's young son Carl has, you know, more time to spend with his famous but somewhat distracted father. Right away, this theme is something I think that young families can relate to. Was that part of your hoping into connecting the present day with appreciation of the past?
Yeah, I think it's a story that, you know, everyone can relate to, and I'm sure it's a story that's kind of timeless too. It very well could have been the case back in Mozart's time. And the idea of the show is that Mozart's son Carl doesn't want to return to the boarding school where he's been. He wants to stay in Vienna with his dad and hang out and perform music with him and listen to, you know, all the things that Mozart's doing. And throughout the course of the show, Mozart realizes that this would be a great opportunity to have his son around, and they begin to, you know, bond and spend more time together looking at all the achievements Mozart's achieved and all the great music that he's composed. So it's sort of a cool way to get inside the music and make a connection to, you know, a storyline and to emotions outside of the pieces.
And in some ways, it sounds like a reversal of how Mozart's real life was with his father, Leopold.
Yes, well, sort of famously, you know, Mozart's relationship with his own dad was complicated because Mozart's dad, Leopold, really pushed him to be the musician that he was and took him at a very young age to this big European tour where Mozart had to perform under great pressure for all the kings and queens and courts throughout Europe. So while Mozart had a chance to spend a lot of time with his dad, it was sort of under rather unusual and sometimes difficult circumstances. And it seems like that's something Mozart doesn't want to reproduce with his own son, Carl, in this show.
Now, you did mention the Magic Flute as being one of the featured numbers. What are some of the other selections that are performed in the show?
Yeah, so kind of throughout the show, they keep returning to the Magic Flute as Mozart describes this, sort of magical fairy tale to his son, which will be something, you know, I'm sure that kids of all ages will really relate to. But you also have a chance to hear some of Mozart's piano music performed both solo and as concerto with the orchestra. And there's also, you know, a variety of things from his other operas like Don Giovanni and The Marriage of Figaro. There's his clarinet quintet, his flute quartet, and even a little bit of his very first symphony, Symphony No. 1, when he was, I can't remember exactly when he wrote it, but I think he was only 6 or 7 years old.
Is this the first young people's concert to come to New Bern?
Yes, it is, and we're really excited to be doing a concert like this in New Bern. We've been, of course, coming to New Bern for years, doing classical concerts, doing concerts outdoors in the summer, but this will be the first one dedicated especially to young people.
The melodies of Mozart's music, along with this big musical theater, seems to be a great way to attract young folks to the wonders of classical music. Is the North Carolina Symphony hoping to continue its partnership with Classical Kids Live for other performances that may come to the area in the future?
Well, we do all sorts of different education and young people's concerts, partnering with a wide variety of different groups. Sometimes there's visual elements, sometimes there's theatrical elements. So every time you come to one of our concerts, it's going to be something different. This particular show, I think, is really a great way because not only do you have the great music. You've also got the storyline that kind of takes you through the hour-long concert and also sort of points your attention into the music and into different things that happen within Mozart's wonderful compositions. And I'd also like to add that, you know, at the concert, there's going to be pre-concert activity. So it's not just the performance that you'll get when you come. The hour before the performance, there's going to be the MetLife Instrument Zoo and hands-on activities with Bare Hands Art Factory. So there's a lot to do at the show, not just the concert itself.
Well, this special Young People's Concert performance once again happens Sunday, March the 8th at 3 p.m. at the Newbern Riverfront Convention Center. Maestro Glover, thank you so much for joining us on the Down East Journal.
Thank you for having me.
Winston Churchill is believed to be the source for the observation that history is written by the victors. The life and subsequent disappearance from history of a North Carolina-born slave and abolitionist illustrates the truth behind that remark. For Black History Month, a look at one of the state's most influential African Americans that many likely know nothing about. George Olson has this, which originally aired in December 2012.
David Soselsky is a historian of some note in the state, a Craven County native who was taught at Duke University, UNC Chapel Hill, and ECU. He's the author or editor of several books examining the history of the eastern region of the state, including works on the 1898 Wilmington race riots and maritime culture during the slave era. He is someone well-versed in the history of this region, which made his initial discovery of the subject of his latest book quite a surprise.
I have really devoted my life as a historian to telling the stories of eastern North Carolina. And while doing research for other books, I kept coming across this mysterious figure, Abraham Galloway, who I had never heard of, going behind enemy lines to rescue his mother from slavery during the war, and, you know, a dozen other stories that made him seem like this larger-than-life, very mysterious and very exciting individual, but I had no idea who he was.
Galloway may be known to some degree in the state as one of the first African Americans in the state legislature. He was one of three elected in 1868, serving a single term. But in Soselsky's opinion, and as laid out in his new book, The Fire of Freedom, Abraham Galloway and the Slave Civil War, Galloway was much more than just a political first in North Carolina history.
Only in time, as I did more and more research, did I come to understand that Galloway was really a national figure and probably the most important African-American figure in the American South during the Civil War. But that was actually late in my research, as I followed him to sort of a now famous meeting with Abraham Lincoln and touring the North as a spokesman for African-American politics during the war.
Galloway went from slave to elected representative in a relatively short time, a slave in 1857, a state senator in 1868, made possible by the leap Galloway took when he made the decision to escape his servitude. David Soselsky reads from The Fire of Freedom.
In early 1857, young Abraham Galloway vowed to depart the world of his childhood. At 20 years old, he had lived by the banks of the Cape Fear River all his life and had never traveled more than a day's journey from his friends and family in Smithville and Wilmington. But that spring, he and a friend grew determined, they later explained, that liberty was worth dying for and that it was their duty to strike for freedom, even if it should cost them their lives.
Galloway made the decision to leave despite having, for a slave, a relatively good life. A brick mason, he could choose his jobs as long as most of the money went to his owner, and this afforded him some bit of freedom that slaves working in a field did not enjoy. But still he left, perhaps a product of an oddity in the South at the time. His father was a white waterman, John Galloway, who, unlike most births involving free white men and enslaved black women, actually acknowledged his son with the slave Hester Hankins.
Said, "This is my son," and Abraham always said later that his father did everything he could to look after him. That had limits, of course, because he wasn't his owner, but all his life, Abraham Galloway spoke well of his father and acknowledged both sides of his heritage. And I do believe that later, as Abraham Galloway becomes such an important political figure, Abraham always went out of his way to bring together blacks and whites in political coalitions. And I think that was partly because of his family roots.
John Galloway was known as charismatic, courageous, and quick-tempered, which were probably descriptors also used to describe his son Abraham, who, after escaping from the South, returned to the South to work as a spy for the Union Army as he joined the fight against the Confederacy. But Soselsky says as fervently as Galloway fought to destroy the Confederacy, he often fought the Union Army for its treatment of slaves it encountered as it moved through the South.
And the second thing that Galloway saw down in Mississippi was the Union Army promised somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200 slaves their freedom if they would help dig a vitally important canal to go around Vicksburg. That did not work, like from an engineering point of view, and the Union Army retreated. And when they retreated, they left those slaves there. So you can imagine their fate. You can imagine how slaveholders in Mississippi would treat those African-American men and women. And these were not things that a man like Abraham Galloway would quickly forgive or forget, and he didn't.
What Abraham Galloway experienced is also telling of the slave population of the time. The typical discussion of the Civil War centers around momentous battles between North and South, but David Soselsky says lost in the retelling of the war is another side, with Abraham Galloway as one of its leaders that attempted to exert its influence on the outcome.
As I did the research for the book, I really began to see there's the North and the South, the Union and the Confederacy, but then there's them. And I really began to see the African Americans of the South as a third force, always determined to destroy the Confederacy, but also wary of the Union in many ways and with their own agenda oriented towards slave liberation.
It was perhaps what Galloway saw in the service of the Union that brought him to an interesting insight on how liberation may be found. It was to be found, not necessarily through social equality, but with access to the ballot box. David Soselsky reads from The Fire of Freedom about an address Galloway gives in 1864 at what is now St. Peter AME Zion Church in New Bern.
At Andrew Chapel, he made clear that he understood that his audience yearned for more than voting rights. He realized that those gathered there still felt the stings of 100 daily reminders of their oppression. Local customs decreed, among much else, that black men and women stepped aside for all white pedestrians, waited in line behind all white customers at stores, sat on the exposed lower decks of steamships, and never shared a dining room with whites. Galloway understood all too well how much the former slaves resented these enduring signs of racial prejudice and hostility. His revolutionary agenda included pushing aside those relics of slavery, but he insisted that they first and foremost stay fixed on voting rights. As for social equality and racial segregation, Galloway told the church that he was willing, and this is a quote, to wait a little longer. But as the Anglo-African's local correspondent quoted him, he wanted his political rights now. Though I should say, of course, that Galloway was notorious for not giving ground on sidewalks, for not conceding any indignity. But when it came to his political thinking, this was one of the most striking times where we see Galloway looking beyond the current moment to that distant future and saying, okay, we can accept some indignities now in exchange for this future vision of equality and political rights. And that was not at all a universal opinion among African American leaders in the South or North at that time. But for Galloway, it was, if we can vote, everything else will follow.
The ballot box got Galloway into the state Senate in 1868, but in terms of everything else will follow, Galloway did not live long enough to shepherd that forward. He died suddenly in 1870 at the age of 33, a time when some of what blacks had won at the ballot box started to retrench and soon gave way to Jim Crow in the South. When Galloway died, it was reported that his funeral was the largest the state had seen up to that time. But soon Galloway was an ignored figure in state history, washed out by an historical narrative that Galloway's radical abolitionism did not fit neatly into.
He was a brilliant individual who really, I really consider one of the most important African-American figures in American history. But for 125 years, I'm sure that no school child ever uttered his name. Immediately after the war, of course, he wasn't forgotten, but in coming years, the South and the North, to some degree, created this almost mythical image of the Civil War. I guess we could call it sort of the Gone with the Wind version. And let's face it, it's hard to imagine Abraham Galloway, who wore two pistols at his hip, punched out Union naval officers, went behind enemy lines to rescue his mother, and would stop at nothing in the struggle for freedom. It's hard to imagine Abraham Galloway in Gone with the Wind.
David Soselsky is the author of The Fire of Freedom, Abraham Galloway and the Slave Civil War, published by UNC Press. I'm George Olson.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. February is the month of seed catalogs, and I seem to receive them all, from the large scale to the heirloom and organic companies, and I love them all. There are so many interesting varieties and options available, many more than you would find as transplants at your local garden center. Of course, when you buy seeds, it takes a little time and attention to grow them to quality transplant size. Some seeds are easier to start indoors than others. Annual vegetables, flowers, and herbs are relatively easy, while perennial flowers, trees, and shrubs can be much trickier. Even among your annual vegetables, some plants grow best if they're sown directly in the garden. A good rule of thumb is that vining plants, like beans and peas and morning glories, should be planted directly in the garden. Corn and root vegetables also do best if they're sown directly in the garden. So once you've identified the best things to start indoors, we need to take into account a couple of things. Timing and light are two of the biggest issues when it comes to starting seeds. Timing is important. Most vegetables and annual flowers should be started about 6 to 8 weeks before you intend to transplant them outside. So late February to early March is a good time to start warm season transplants like tomatoes and peppers for setting out in mid to late April. Very fast growing seedlings like squash, melons, and cucumbers should be started only 3 to 4 weeks before transplanting. It's actually better to start a little late rather than too early. A small, healthy seedling will outperform a larger, stressed seedling when you actually get it in the garden. The second consideration is light. Light can be hard to come by in late winter. If you have a south-facing window, it may provide enough light for a couple of small containers. But if you're going to start several flats, consider investing in a grow light. Grow lights are relatively inexpensive, and you can hang them so they're positioned about 6 to 8 inches above the top of your containers. I like to adjust mine upwards as the seedlings grow. If possible, set your grow light on a timer, providing 14 hours of light each day. If you opt for the window method, make sure that you turn your seedlings daily to ensure that their stems grow straight and sturdy. You can use a wide variety of containers for seed starting. Just make sure that they have adequate drainage. Pop holes in the bottom of plastic yogurt containers, or repurpose the plastic clamshells that berries come in at the grocery store. I prefer to use the seed starting kits that come with cell inserts in humidity domes. I find them on sale at the end of each growing season, toss away the compressed peat pellets, and fill them with my favorite seed starting mix. If you want to reuse plastic containers, you can sanitize them by dipping the clean containers in a 10% bleach solution and allowing them to air dry. Once you've chosen your container, fill it with a quality sterile seed starting mix. Water your container gently to settle the mix before planting your seed, and then follow the directions on your seed packet. But a good rule of thumb is to plant your seeds at a depth that is 1 to 2 times their size. For very small seeds, I like to use a kitchen sieve to gently sift a layer of seed starting mix over the seeds to cover. Cover your containers with plastic wrap or a humidity dome to keep them moist until the seeds germinate. And then once the seedlings emerge, uncover the containers and water them gently from below or with a mist nozzle as the mix starts to dry out. When the first true leaves emerge, you can start feeding your seedlings weekly with a half-strength fertilizer solution. I like to use a fan to gently circulate air around my seedlings. This helps to prevent disease and also helps to strengthen their stems. You can even brush your hands across the seedlings daily to help provide them with just a little stress and help them develop sturdy stems. When it's time to transplant your seedlings outside, slowly acclimate them by moving them to a protected location. Start with an east-facing porch, out of the prevailing winds, and then gradually expose them to more sun and wind over the course of 3 to 4 days before setting them out in the garden. With a little attention to detail, you can be starting all of the new, unusual, or heirloom varieties that your heart desires. So page through those seed catalogs and make a list of your favorites. Just make sure there's enough room in the garden for all of your new seedlings.
The Downeast Journal is made possible by our Public Radio East members in partnership with Eastern Carolina Ear, Nose, and Throat Head and Neck Surgery, Greenville, including Doctors Kamnitz, Albernez, Lindbeck, Brechtilsbauer, Brodish, and Workman, offering comprehensive medical and surgical management of diseases of the head and neck. Thanks for listening to the show. Have a great weekend.